Dr. Hingorani, who joined us from NYU. It's going to be about our worst nightmare using filters.
So nowadays, you can't really go on the television and not see an ad from a lawyer regarding IVC filters and litigation. This prompted us a couple years ago to start looking at this data, and most of this is from based upon work that one of our students had done last year. I have no disclosures. IVC filters, as you can hear from the panel, remain controversial, and they remain a significant source of medical malpractice. When you look at the literature, though, however, what is the literature regarding these medical malpractice suits? And there really isn't a lot out there. We really wanted to look at some of the key issues and outcomes of this litigation. So we retrospectively reviewed two legal databases, specifically looking at IVC filters. We reviewed the LexisNexis and the Westlaw databases. Now, these are databases consisting of decades of information. They collect information from all 50 states. These are the two largest databases, and they go back all the way to 1967. When we searched for IVC filters in these two databases, we entered with 310 initial cases. However, when we looked at them more closely, many of them, the majority of them, were tax revenue cases, insurance disputes, cases involving Social Security, disability cases, and that eliminated all 281. And we only ended up with 29 cases, reported published cases, between all federal and state cases of IVC filters that resulted in litigation and were completed. So again, this we reviewed from 1967 to 2016, and these databases also review 800 journals across the U.S. and Supreme Court decisions. So who is being sued? The majority of them were indeed private practice. However, the number two defendants were academic centers. What were the most common indications for IVC filters in these cases? In this small series, we were surprised. It was actually hypercoagulable states was the number one indication for IVC filters in this series. Not for the trauma patients, not the prophylactic filters, and not recurrent DVT or PEs. What were the most common underlying allegations in these cases? Most often, it was failure to insert a filter when indicated. Again, not that you didn't remove the filter, that it perforated the IVC or perforated the duodenum or the aorta, and not intraoperative complications, which is where often we thought we were going to see most of the complications. It was the opposite. You didn't put in a filter, and the patients had a PE. So the most common identified complications were failure to prevent PE, and again, not device migration and not perforation of the adjacent organs or vasculature. So the most common indications for these procedures were trauma and DVT, and 12 of these patients actually died, as reported by these case series. And of these 12, again, the most common indications were trauma and DVT. Of the cases that had reported outcomes of these cases, which were only 14, 13 of the 14 actually were in favor of the defendant. And again, most of those were due to DVT and PE. Of the defendants, 8 of them were vascular surgeons and 2 of them radiology, and then there's a subsequent mishmash of other specialists involved. The most common states that were involved, not surprisingly, were New York, Ohio, and Pennsylvania, and the majority of these commenced in jurisdictions on the East Coast. Having looking at this data, we were somewhat unsatisfied. We wanted more information. We wanted to find out what type of filters were being placed, what were the complications. Unfortunately, this review really doesn't have that granular data that we would want as clinicians. Some of the limitations is that the majority of these cases that were introduced during this time period were actually settled. It's estimated about 90% of these cases will be settled and would not end up in these databases. If they're pending litigation, then they're not reported in this database. However, we did have significant questions. There did seem to be some interstate variability, and these large cases that are being class action suits may have a significant influence on some of these cases because they don't go in these databases as of yet since they're pending. There are other databases that are available, but they tend to be a little bit smaller and they tend to have significant problems also. Based upon these data, we suggest that overall, these verdicts did favor the defendants. Private practitioners were most commonly sued. And the most common reasons for bringing the suit were failure to insert the filter, not interprocedural complications, not procedures, not problems after the placement of the filter. Based upon these, we do feel that looking at these type of data will help inform clinical practice and inform and improve patient safety. Thank you.
Dr. Higurani, please join us. Thank you, everybody. I would like to see if anybody from the audience would like to have any questions. If not, then, okay. Go ahead, please. Yeah, so the orthopods in our institution try to push us sometimes to place them. I think I have not placed one prophylactically. I think if they have if they developed a DVT and they're still they failed anticoagulation, I would place them, but I have not placed them prophylactically.
We've actually had a recent shift the last 8-10 years where we're not getting all those calls anymore. Because of the data showing the long-term complications of IVC filters in these patients. So we stopped getting those calls. We're not putting them in. They're putting them on anticoagulation of one sort or another, but I think more and more people are not putting in filters for those softer indications.
Yes, go ahead.
Unfortunately, we don't have more granular data because they're quite limited, these reviews. They're basically a synopsis of the case and the outcome. And they're not mandated to report these to these. But if they do complete litigation, these databases actually collect all of the results and summate them. So we don't have the granular data about what were the indications, why were the patients being evaluated for a filter, and how did they end up with a PE? We don't have the results of that. But 14 of these patients did die. So I think, and they're not.
They're not filter patients. The claim was they should have had, and here we are talking about why.
But I would actually claim that maybe we're not focusing on all the indications for litigation for these. I would say that sometimes there are indications for these patients to receive a filter, and if you end up missing one of those patients and having a PE, I think you're also at risk.
I think that is the message.
From our data, our number one indication for these lawsuits in these 29 cases, which is limited, was failure to put in the filter and the subsequent PE.
So maybe just for the sake of discussion, maybe we can tell the audience what type of filter each one of us use in any particular filters in particular scenarios. What do you like or not like about particular commercial filters? Dr. Higurani.
We have very limited. We basically have switched from the argon-based filters, and now we're going back to the select filters in our hospital. Not because we want to, it's what we have and are available in our hospital. Mm-hmm. I sort of wish we had more different types of filters available, because I think there are advantages and disadvantages to each filter in a particular patient, but we don't have them available.
I'll answer the question, but I also wanted to make a comment that, you know, if I was a surgeon sitting here trying to figure out how am I at risk, et cetera, kind of like the question that was asked, I would say that as opposed to Dr. Hingorani's presentation, what you're seeing now on television, et cetera, are class action lawsuits sponsored, backed financially by venture capitalists who are going for the big money. They're going after the filter companies. They're not going after the surgeons, as far as I know, and that it might be an interesting comment that that's why Dr. Hingorani didn't find that many in that way. So they're going after the big money, and that's why you see all of the advertising, et cetera. So I think the message I would like you to take away from today is that we don't have a lot of data, but filters are safe. I mean, the filter isn't the problem. The filter is the indication and then how we deal with it. And as a matter of fact, even prophylactic filters, I think, as you've heard, really aren't the problem, as long as you take them out. And if you're up to 80% retrieval rate, in other words, put them in, take them out, put them in, take them out, for that one day period that you're at a bleeding risk for hemorrhage from a head injury or multi-trauma patient, okay, fine, take it out and anticoagulate the patient. That's all good, you know, and you're helping the patient. So filters are safe. Prophylactic, I think current era is okay, but you really don't need it for very long. If you can get them by with squeezy pumps and something else, that's why SCDs and stuff like that are class one indications. But if you put it in, take it out. Take it out before they go home. And same thing with many of these other things. You know, if you're gonna put it in for IV for DVT lysis, put it in, put them on the schedule to take it out in a short-term follow-up within the IFU of whatever filter it is. For with that being said, currently with the PRESERVE trial, because nobody else will put in the trapeze filter, Optiz filter, I put in all Optiz. I don't have complications. I mean, it's a nice filter, it works. It's a little bit long, so I don't really like that, but you can put it in from the groin, you can take it out from the groin, it works fine.
Well, in my institution, there is a competition and the best offer goes in. And so at the University of Pittsburgh, we have two filters on the shelf. The one is the Cook, the Select, and the other is the Denali. As far as my preference, I mean, we have residents, so we have to use both. I use more frequently the Select. We are more familiar. It's easier to deploy. But whenever I have to go through the left axis, I think the Denali shows less tilt. So whenever I go through the left, I will place the Denali. When I go through the right, that's most of the times I would place a Select. I also have to make a comment regarding challenging retrievals. What's the real benefit of subjecting our patients to open surgery, as you suggested, or to a complex retrieval, acknowledging the possible risks that come with it? Are we actually helping our patients or our ego to remove these challenging filters? I have been very aggressive in the past removing permanent filters that were there for 5-10 years, till one day I got the really bad complication of removing the vena cava with the filter. So since then, I'm kind of very shy in fighting to remove these filters because I'm not convinced that I'm helping these patients.
Yeah, I agree with that. I've become increasingly conservative both with putting them in and then taking them out. I think the majority of the referrals we get to take them out are actually in asymptomatic patients. And a lot of times I'll just tell those folks to not worry about it. As far as which filter, I think you can find evidence to support whatever you want to do. I tend to avoid the opposed biconical filters. And I think the older generation Select, we and some others published some experiences of a little bit higher rates of perforation. But I think largely they're the same. I'm also all for simplicity. This filter will remain nameless, but I was on call one weekend and had to put a filter, and all we had was this kind. It had two buttons and a switch on it. I had to call my partner to figure out how to put it in when you can just do a pin pull. So that, to me, was a little bit funny.
I personally, my experience is very much mirrors Dr. Avgerino's. I used to use the Select, and I use actually preferably the Denali. I think it centers even from the right or from the left, especially if you have to put a filter coming from the left. The Denali and the filter are more like second generation filters from the manufacturers Cook and Bard. And what they have is the initial iteration of the Select with the Gunther Tulip, which is the first retrieval filter, and tilting was the major problem with it. So the Select is a modification of the design where there are like small feathers that kind of open up and help center the filter, and the Denali had it's a totally different reiteration from the prior, but it involves with the delivery of the device a mechanism to center the filter inside the IVC. And I think these are probably the filters that give the best aligning. And both are relatively easy to retrieve. And these are the ones that I use most. Regarding the comment on retrieval of IVC filters, I agree. I mean, I think it's a case by case. I think if a patient is asymptomatic and had a filter for a long time, it's if it's a retrievable filter, I've been aggressive. because I think these you can get those out most of the time. Even I've taken some 8 years out because they had penetration, and it's true the patient may not have symptoms at the time, but you know the duodenum is only a few millimeters away, and the aorta sometimes is only a few millimeter away, and the reality is the longer we wait, there's all those filters that were placed 10 years ago. We're seeing a lot of those complications. So I think if the patient doesn't need it, if it has signs of perforation or adjacent to structures, vital structures, I tend to remove them. When it comes to permanent filters, it's a little different. These permanent filters don't have very thin struts. For example, the green field filter have recurved hooks. So when these open up and start penetrate into organs, this is not like a spear going in. This is like a totally curved limb that's going into that that organ, and it becomes really encased. And actually, a couple of years ago, we had to do an open retrieval of a filter, and one of the struts was in the head of the pancreas, and we could not remove it. The head of the pancreas was going to fall apart. We were like pulling very hard, and we had the surgical oncologist there. We could not. We had to clip it and leave part of it behind. So these are challenging, and. I agree. I think it's a case by case, and it's a very important to have a good discussion with the patient about risks, benefits, and what's the goals of the procedure or whatever procedure we're doing.
I might just add one technical comment, Cassius, and that is that after getting referrals to remove a filter with a laparotomy after a recent attempt at an endovascular removal, I've learned to wait a couple weeks on those because there can be some opening of the cava that's closed by the retroperitoneum that you open at the time of surgery, and that becomes a little unpleasant. So.
Very good point. All right, we still have some time for discussion. Any other questions?
If you want to space it in, I can bring the mic to you.
So Cassius, since you discussed about techniques for placement of an IVC filter, many times after we place the filter, we see some tilt. It can be mild and it's okay, but sometimes the tilt may be moderate or even significant. Are you going to just leave it in or just fight to align it?
I usually just leave it in.
Leave it in. So I wonder what are the implications of leaving in a filter that is tilted?
It's a great question.
Nobody knows.
It's less effective, I guess. Some of the older studies show that if you have tilt, your filtration becomes less effective. But in principle, I mean, so again, there's no data that shows decreased mortality with using IVC filters. There's probably one study from the NIS that showed it in critically patient, there's less mortality, but it's kind of a hard thing to prove. But I mean, the major goal is to try to prevent the big clot that's going to the lung that's going to kill a patient. And I think if your filter is tilted to a certain extent, it will probably still capture it. Sir, go ahead.
I think the is of necessity eccentric. As it is getting into the vena cava, there is no way to keep it in the center. And the filter design has no mechanism for it to self-center. Whichever side is towards the wall is going to come out first, and the other side is going to tilt up. If anybody does the study on CT scans, the tilt is a lot more common than we wish that would. And unless there is a change in design, which given all this environment, I doubt is ever going to happen.
I agree. I mean, I think to a certain extent, I agree with what you said, that there's always a little bit of tilt. And when we're doing venography, we're looking at a two-plane image. A lot of time there's posterior tilt and we cannot really appreciate it. But the reality is actually the newer devices do center very well. And I know that because those patients get CAT scans afterwards and you can see the hook of the filter is may not be exactly in the center, but it's somewhere close to the middle.
And,
so the Denali and the Select.
The Denali filter, I think it does, but even with Select, I did a lot of CT scan for every filter.
Yeah, the Select, sometimes the feathers actually get stuck, and I had a couple of cases, actually they tilted because of those centering mechanism feathers, but nothing is perfect. Please go ahead. So that's a very good question. So it's not a, it's a good comment, because we do see that sometimes you take the filter and then the patient gets a DVT or a PE afterwards and they're like, you know. So I mean, it can happen. It definitely happens. We know at our institution it happened a couple of times. This is why my approach, when I gave my presentation, I thought I typically wait until the patient has recovered. So I try not to remove filters within a few days, 2 or 3 days. Like if I put a filter, I'm leaving in it at least for a few months. I want to make sure the patient is back to their baseline. They got all their surgeries done and they're tolerating their anticoagulation. So I typically wait on those.
Even if they are on anticoagulation?
Yeah. You know, because you know, the next week they may develop bleeding, and then you're like, okay, we have to put another filter. Yes, go ahead, please.
Can I share a comment from a patient of mine who I talked to? He was so convinced that his last sentence to me was, he would rather die rather than have a filter.
Yeah, I guess TV and ads, you know, have power. So regarding that, we did a study actually that's being actually going to be published, accepted, it's in press, where we looked at patients who had filters and were missed to follow up. So these are patients who potentially could have been removed filters, and then we track them, and we actually 5 years later we did a survey with those patients just to see why those patients did not follow up. So 12% of them, or 16%, I can't remember exactly the number, did not know that they had a filter in. So they were probably in the ICU or something, they had a filter, went out, never heard about the filter. And a certain proportion of them were told actually by their internist and by their primary care physician that it's a greenfield filter, it doesn't come out. So these are probably more old school PCPs who don't know about new filters. Correct. Okay, and so during that study we also looked at the effect of commercial insurance on the patients and what their attitudes around the commercial insurance. Basically the ad for litigation, and most of the patients actually were not. None of them felt that they have to go or sue or. They thought that all those litigations were not to be trusted, and most of the patients actually trusted their doctor, which was a good result. And the other thing, but the good thing is that a lot of the patients thought that these litigations were kind of eye-opening for them to go and ask, to seek advice, medical advice, basically, with their doctors. So just a little point about, you know, the effect of the commercials on patients. Right, so let me end with a little scenario that came with me a few times. So if you have a patient goes in for a knee replacement, they get prophylaxis, standard prophylaxis around the knee replacement, get a PE, gets treated. Okay, no hypercoagulable, no other factors. Same patient comes for a knee replacement for the other leg a year or two later. What do you put an IVC filter prophylactically or not?
And hypercoagulable workup is negative.
Negative. So provoked DVT, despite, you know, whatever prophylaxis they had. Do you put a filter? You do not put a filter? Do you tell them to go higher on the prophylaxis? What's your thoughts?
There's no clear-cut data, obviously, about what to do with these patients. And we've actually put in the filter, put in a temporary filter with the caveat that we tell the patient, you're coming back, you're going to have this filter removed, it's going to be temporary, and hopefully it'll prevent another PE.
David?
Yeah, I agree with that. I mean, if he did have another PE DVT, I'd probably anticoagulate him for life, you know. But I think you're saving his life based on other evidence.
I would definitely place it.
Michael.
You know, I it has to be case by case. The more risk factors you have piled up on the side of occurrence, the more likely you are. But when I think for that specific case, to me, I probably would not. I would probably make sure that you got mechanical and pharmacologic prophylaxis and treat them with lifelong anticoagulation if you got another one. So.
All right. Yes, we have a couple of questions.
Just follow up on that. How do you time when to remove? Some of these patients are, especially the knee replacement patients, it can take them time to become fully mobile.
So I typically wait until they're finished the physical therapy, they're close or as close to their baseline as possible.
What about the major under patients when you deploy a stent? Do you deploy first the filter or simultaneously or not?
So it depends. So I don't.
If you have a recurrence, for example, in an iliofemoral thrombosis, mm-hmm.
So that's a good question. So there's multi-level, things to discuss in this. So first, is this an acute DVT or is this somebody who's coming with iliac vein compression? So if it's an acute DVT, typically my approach is if somebody comes in with a DVT and has a PE, I put a filter, I lyse, and I stent. If they come in with no PE, then I don't put a filter, I just lyse and stent. There's one study that shows that if you put filters on all patients who you do DVT thrombolysis on, you will decrease the incidence of PEs, but it's not going to affect mortality. And this is my approach.
For the sake of the debate, we have moved away on placing IVC filter in patients who had acute DVT and we're planning on thrombolyzing. The only filters we might place an IVC filter are the patients who present with acute DVT and pulmonary embolism and we're planning to lyse. But the majority of our patients will not receive an IVC filter during thrombolysis.
Yeah, I would agree with what Cash has said. That's the data. And I think I agree that In a routine thrombolysis patient, I would use it on a case by case basis. Somebody with a previous history of PE, I'd probably put it. And just for the sake of argument, I think all our professions need to get away from using old dead surgeons' names for diseases like May Thurner, because it you can see it's the Tower of Babel. We have no idea what you're talking about. And Raju could, coined the terms long ago with Peter Negland, thrombotic and non-thrombotic iliac vein occlusion. That says it pretty clearly. And so in non-thrombotic iliac vein obstruction, I don't put filters.
I thought there was a paper about 10, 15 years ago that reported incidence of PE with thrombolysis or something.
Well, I think Cash has quoted it, and I don't think the Yeah. It says it happens, but it's not fatal, and it still doesn't answer the question.
Yep. And theoretically, you're treating the clot that's embolizing because you're giving TPA.
The only reason I was bringing that up is I saw this patient die in front of me.
Yeah.
With the trouble with the catheter.
Yep.
That'll convince you every time.
Some anecdotes are very powerful.
Yep. I agree. All right. That will conclude our session. Thank you very much, everybody, and enjoy the meeting.